This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends. Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Ruth Todd and Maureen Rout. Exciting news, Maureen.
Yes, three Canterbury writers are in the shortlisted, the shortlists for the Ockham New Zealand Book Awards. So congratulations to Anna Rogers, to Eric Kennedy and to Chessie Henry.
I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled for them. And I'm also excited. The four fiction writers are ones we've interviewed, and they would be my picks too.
Well, there you go. So that was Lloyd Jones. It was Fiona Kidman, Vincent O'Sullivan and Kate Doignan. Very good. We'll look forward to hearing what the outcome is.
So this week I'm talking with Deborah Shepherd, who's written a wonderful book. She's done the oral histories with 12 senior, I suppose they're the senior fiction writers. Oh, yes, they're all fiction writers in our country, about the same, getting on to me, my age, some of them. And it's a great thing that she's done because she's put them, at Nicola Leggett's suggestion, and they're all in one book. And she's interviewed them all with the same questions. And I just think it's such a great resource for people to have. I found out things about those writers, a lot of whom I've interviewed, that I didn't know before. So lucky to have Deborah Shepherd down from Auckland in Christchurch face-to-face, Deborah, because this is a very, very special book, and we'll get on to that in a minute. But you're an author, teacher of memoir, oral historian and film and art historian. You've just loved doing these things. I've talked to you before about the one you did, Her Life's Work, the conversations with five New Zealand women. Loved that. And then you've done one, Partners in Art, Reframing Women, History of New Zealand Film, and Giving Yourself to Life, which was a more personal one, a journal of pain, hope and renewal. You just love nonfiction where you can talk to other people, talk to writers, talk to artists, talk to filmmakers.
Yes, a lot of the books that you mentioned were based on the oral history interview. I just love it as a mode and a method of information gathering, because it's a dynamic interchange between the author and the narrator, and it's going to the people who have lived through the history and asking them to narrate their experience of it. And in this case, I was so very fortunate to be working with storytellers and skilled wordsmiths who are involved daily in the craft of intellectual analysis, reflection and imagining, and are primed to reach in deep for their answers. So this was an extra special project.
It was indeed, and it's the book that has resulted is The Writing Life, 12 New Zealand authors. Deborah Shepherd has put them together in a book, thank goodness, for me. And people, especially, I'm the same sort of generation as these writers. I've interviewed all of them, I think, and some of them several times. And so it's a real joy to have them here. And it's an amazing project to have, that New Zealand Society of Authors or History. What was the genesis? How did it begin?
Because I think that comment you made about it being put into a book, the thing about this kind of interview is it's ephemeral in a way, although now it's available online, of course.
Yes.
But to have it set down, the crafted conversations into the book, we've got that now for posterity, and it's a precious resource, I think.
It is. Well, it is, and the photographs of the writers in their workplace, and the details of their all the wonderful things they've achieved. It's so marvellous to have it all in one volume.
And so this book, its genesis was in an oral history project that the New Zealand Society of Authors conceived back in 1999. It was Philip Temple, one of the authors in the book, who came up with the idea. And the aim was to gather information from distinguished members of the Writing Society about their involvement and contribution to the society. So the first two series were conducted by the late Michael King, historian, and the researcher and oral historian Alison Gray. And then those were conducted in 1999 and 2005, and they've currently been podcasted and are available to listen to on the New Zealand Society of Authors website. This stage three, it was 10 years later that the CEO of the time, Jackie Dennis, gorgeous woman, who was looking for the podcast content for the Society's website, and she advertised for an oral historian to continue the investigation begun in the earlier series.
And you were the lucky one.
I was the lucky one. The thing I argued for, though, was for a wider, more holistic examination of the life and work, because I felt in those earlier interviews that an opportunity had been missed to gather the bigger story. And some of those authors in that series have obviously, they've since died, Christine Colk Hatley, Loris Edmund, people like that. And so they agreed, but it did mean a lot of extra work for me. It meant it was like cramming for exams, actually, because I only really had about a 2 to 2.5 week turnaround to prepare. So I was reading night and day, novels, the poetry collections, the short stories, the non-fiction projects, the memoirs in preparation. But I was very excited when I saw this notice in the Society of Authors Bulletin looking for an oral historian, because I saw immediately that this was an opportunity to capture and preserve the recollections and insights of this singular generation, as you've just said, of elder New Zealand writers who'd been developing their craft over a 60-year period during a defining period in this country's evolution of its literary
history. And a golden age period, really. I'm so glad I've lived at this time, because it was sort of a golden age of publishing. I mean, publishing is all sorts of problems now.
Yes.
But when they were at their peak, I suppose,
yes,
the publishing was a breeze, wasn't it?
It was. In those days, they could enjoy a long and secure relationship with a publisher who helped shape their career. That's gone. But also we need to remember that they emerged out of a cultural vacuum. I open the book with a quotation from a landmark essay, Fretful Sleepers, by Bills Pearson, which was published in Landfall, the literary journal, in 1952. And he was studying at Oxford University at that time. And he, from that distant vantage point, he was able to reflect upon aspects of New Zealand literature that he found lacking. So he described the unthinking, threadbare life of New Zealand citizens as dumb and numb, null and dull, and longed for talent to be realised, for emotions to be examined, so there could be greater depth, more joy, heavier sorrow. He said, there is an aching need for art in our country. We need an art to expose ourselves to ourselves, explain ourselves to ourselves, see ourselves in a perspective of time and place. So that when that was published in 1952, the generation of authors who are the focus of the study, so that's Joy Cowley, Marilyn Duckworth, Tessa Duda, Chris Else, Patricia Grace, David Hill, Witty Ihamaira, Fiona Kidman, Owen Marshall, Vincent O'Sullivan, Philip Temple, and Albert Wendt. They were all at secondary school at that time, and their education was based on a British curriculum that advanced a Eurocentric version of history. So they are the authors that took us up out of this vacuum through their work, through six decades of work, to the place that we all enjoy now, with books that represent the diverse cultural richness of this place.
And that's such a thrill that they all came at once, really. I mean, you know, they didn't sort of straggle along, did they?
They were led by Marilyn Duckworth. She was the first to publish in 1959, A Gap in the Spectrum. She was published, though, by UK publishers, her first four books. were published in the UK, as were Joy Cowley's in the US. It took a little while for the publishing industry to develop a momentum, didn't it? And one of the publishers that really helped that along was Bert Hingley at Hodder and Stoughton, who championed most of these authors. His name crops up again and again in the interviews. And that's another thing about this that's so precious, is that because they are all of the same generation, but you've got, what you've got is 12 different takes on that same history. So they're all marking the same turning points in the development, the same stages and phases, but from their own perspectives. But there's lots of cross-fertilisation.
So you decided to ask them the same questions and the topics that you covered.
Yes.
Why did you do that? To get for that this, uniformity.
To get that history gathering like that. And I suppose I teach memoir, and what I find is that often the childhood years are the years that people write with the most sort of skill and joy and pleasure in the remembering of that period, which is a nascent time in a person's life, where everything is new. You're discovering the world for the first time. And memories tend to be much stronger of the childhood years, as opposed to the blur of middle age. We were all so busy raising children and working and so on and so forth. So I do have a particular interest.
Well, I was so glad you did that, because I thought, oh, well, I know a lot about these people. And I didn't. I learnt so much more because of you developing the formative years and them talking about those.
I remember thinking in the Patricia Grace interview, as she talked about her childhood, oh, I haven't read this anywhere. This is not on the public record, and it's all so fresh and new and
I know, and that was what was wonderful, yes, and that's what I've remembered straight away from all of them, rather than their work. I know most of their work, but I didn't know about their childhood and formative years, because we only talk about their work when I interview them.
That's true. So in that questioning, I was interested in how their childhood experience had shaped their responses to the world, and whether there was a causal chain of events that led from an early interest in books to realising the writing dream. And I wondered about suffering, and it's often argued that's a necessary condition of art, and was that the case here? And how did childhood losses, the death of a parent, and family stresses and strains affect young writer egos? I also wanted to know about the role of play and creativity in their young lives. And did they grow up with books in the home? Were they read to at night? And did that make a difference? And I loved it when Albert Wendt talked about the family gathering each night in his grandmother's whale in Samoa for a service that consisted of a hymn, a Bible reading, a prayer and song. And he talked of being immersed in this ocean of the Bible, language, music and history. And then I also asked about parental influence on the writing life. And so, for instance, Marilyn Duckworth grew up in a writing family. Her mother was already a writer. Her sister is Fleur Adcock, the poet. Her father was a psychology lecturer who wrote psychology lectures. So they read around the table at nights. They discussed books. But then equally, there were people like Joy Cowley who struggled to learn to read, and as did her son. And I think that's one of the reasons why she worked with him as a little boy, writing stories about the farm and what he would do when he grew up and was a farmer. And that's where all her books for children stem
from.
And
what a collection, what a treasure, aren't they? Yeah. Wonderful.
Absolutely. And then I asked her about the role of mentors, and were there people that stepped in at a critical point? And Fiona Kidman wrote about winning a prize at the age of 10 for children's writing. And a reader wrote and said, and that she won it in the newspaper, and said, one day you may grow up to be a journalist or a librarian or a famous writer. And in fact, she was all of those.
Yes.
She started out as a librarian.
Yes, she did. Yes.
And wrote for the listener
as well.
So
that feedback and that nurturing from outside people, their readers, as well as their family and whoever supported them, and partners, and later on, and family, you know, their current families, that makes a huge difference to them. You know, they weren't so isolated because they had that sort of around them, didn't they? A ring around them of people when the tough times they
when
could go to. Yes.
Yes. I was also interested to ask them about this vacuum they emerged out of and the impact of that paucity of a New Zealand-based literature when they were growing up. Because Joy Cowley said, nowhere did I find in my own country in the books. I was of the opinion we were unworthy of books and that there was something inferior about being a Kiwi. But then, especially amongst the writers for children and young people, so that was there was Patricia Grace, David Hill, Tessa Duda and Joy Cowley.
And Margaret Mahe, of course.
And Margaret Mahe. And what I found was that situation had fired their resolve to write or to provide empowering stories for younger readers. That position Kiwi children and their familiar environs at the heart of the story. I also was interested in the educational opportunities and their early work and their first encounters with New Zealand writers and whether they'd glimpsed in those writers the possibility of the writing vocation. So they all of them mentioned Catherine Mansfield, although she was somewhat remote, having written in Europe. Frank Sargeson, they all mentioned, Janet Frame as well. But for Patricia Grace, it was Amelia Battistich and also Hone Tuwhare and his work. And
yes, I was interested in Amelia Battistich.
Yes.
Battistich,
yes,
isn't it?
Battistich,
and,
yes,
because I read her, and I've never read her for years, and I don't know anybody who does now. But
right.
And I was very interested that Patricia Grace should look to her.
Someone
as an immigrant woman.
Yes, ancestry, yes. Writing about the people she knew, which was obviously what Patricia then, her whole writing life, has been writing about. Her Māori experience, although she had an English mother, and that's where her lovely blue eyes come from. So she grew up with her Pākehā relatives around her, but it was the weekends spent at Hongaweka Bay with her Māori whānau that were most important to her. But she has also said that it was her treatment at school, where she was treated as a Māori girl, that made her decide, well, that therefore I will write about my Māori identity. Of course, there was discrimination towards her. The nuns didn't believe that she was 5 because she arrived at school able to read, and they argued with her and said, you must be 7. And similarly with her maths, she was too clever at her maths. They didn't believe a Māori girl could be that clever.
Awful.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
It is unbelievable. Mm. But she, I can just see her sitting there and saying, well, I know that I am what I am. And she wouldn't have argued.
No, she was
very
polite. I got the sense that she was brought up with, surrounded by so much love in her childhood. Her family believed in her.
And that's all she needed.
Her through the rest of it, yes.
Oh, everyone's a treasure, and I'm going to go back and dip into, at various times I'll dip into several and look at their, sort of compare their answers to your questions and see more than I've already seen because I've read it fairly quickly right through. But I just think to have this resource in one volume is a huge achievement for New Zealand. And Nicola Leggett for instigating it.
Absolutely. Mm. So obviously I conducted the first series of interviews, which was 8 interviews. And as I was listening, in fact, even at the very first interview with Philip Temple, covering the great breadth of his life, starting out as this little boy in England with no father, and his mother went off to London for work, and he was being raised by his grandparents in a Yorkshire village, and it was tough. He He slept in the same cot until the age of 7. He slept in the fetal position. He had the same pair of shoes that his mother had left him with. So he had stunted feet. And that's a man who came out here and climbed mountains exactly. in the Southern Alps and based his early books on that. So great sweep of a life. And I sat there thinking, this is huge. And there, yes, we have the oral history interviews which can be tapped into, but we need a book. And so then I went to Nicola Leggett and I had the 8 and she said, no, we need to widen the frame to ensure that you have, you know, some more of our great authors. Unfortunately, I couldn't interview everyone and some authors were unavailable.
There might be another book.
and there may well be another podcast, another oral history
yes.
series.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm, that would be wonderful.
Yes.
Well, I wondered what appeals to you as the interviewer for oral history? What do you get out of it for something? You
yes.
must have rewards for you to put all this time and effort into it. Well,
I love listening to people's stories, and,
yes.
and you know, I teach memoirs, so I live in that world of helping people, whether it's through telling it or writing it, to give voice to their story. But I had an interesting experience as an oral historian in that when I started here in Canterbury at the McDougall Art Gallery with a summer student job, where I interviewed the painter Bill Sutton. I was 22. I had very little idea of what I was doing, but I was so lucky that he was the very first person I interviewed because he was such an erudite man, a great storyteller and very gracious, and he almost led me through the interview. But then I returned to Canterbury in the late 1980s as a young mother needing something more than that in my life. And I did a paper in the recently formed Feminist Studies Department, and I was introduced to a feminist participatory model of gathering these stories. And so what we looked at was we looked at the imbalance of power in traditional sociological, anthropological methodologies, where you would have an all-knowledgeable researcher going into a community and someone with wealth and power interviewing the subject, who was usually anonymous, and drawing out the answers, then using the material to write papers that would improve the status of the researcher. But there was no reciprocity, nothing given back. And so a feminist participatory model encourages their involvement and collaboration. So my approach is to do the research and do a lot of it and be well prepared, and then to supply topic sheets for the individuals. And in this case, they were pages and pages long because I was using, I was quoting from novels and poems and sections in the memoir, reviews, and so on. But I always think that when you do that extra, make that extra effort, the person you interviewed is more likely to take the interview more seriously. And I think that's why these authors responded with such generosity as well. I was amazed at their willingness to go into it in real depth.
And we often don't have time these days. I mean, we're doing a longer interview today for Bookends, but normally we don't have that time. And it's a luxury these days,
yes.
often. So
yes.
it's wonderful that we can still do some longer ones because so many, well, for me, I can't think of any writers in New Zealand who aren't keen to give as much as they can if you've done your homework and if you've read their book, whichever
yes.
it is. And it's usually one book at a time that we talk about.
Yes.
But there's always so much more, and this is why this is so important.
And the value of this particular collaborative process is that after the transcription of the interview, the verbatim transcription, when you're crafting it for a book, that's then my chance to go back to the authors and to get them sometimes to expand on some of the answers, or just to clarify. And I find that this absolutely enriches the final product, that toing and froing in discussion. Sometimes I can ask an extra question that I forgot to ask in the interview, because so often, as is happening here, I think, you know, you can dart off in lots of different directions. But in that editing process, we were able to, yes.
Finally, Deborah, I'm talking with Deborah Shepherd about her new book, The Writing Life, 12 New Zealand Authors. Sustenance for the writers. It's not an easy job to be a writer, is it, to earn enough money to feed a family? Most of these writers had full-time jobs in the beginning.
They did, and
other jobs, I mean.
Yes, and in my earlier projects, it was always a feminist project. So this one, with its ratio of 7 males to 5 female writers, was it nudged me to consider the different compromises that the men had to make. And that was interesting, because in those intensive parenting years, they didn't have the luxury of all the time to write a novel, because they were working. So David Hill and Owen Marshall were both secondary school teachers. They didn't publish their first novels till they were in their 50s. Witi Ihumaira worked as a diplomat during those years, he said, to put kai on the table. Philip Temple took on a lot of Reader's Digest projects during those years because it was lucrative, didn't have the time to write a novel. So those were the compromises that the men had to deal with. The women, of course, it's the juggling act, being
always
running the home and caring for and raising the children, but the real will and desire to create. When the children have gone to bed, then the women were up writing.
Deborah, we could go on. People, I'm sure, have got a feel for this book now, to want to find it and read about these 12 New Zealand authors, because I challenge you that you don't know everything there is to know about them, however many interviews you've listened to or reviews you've read. There's so much new in this book. So thank you for putting it together, The Writing Life, 12 New Zealand Authors by Deborah Shepherd, and it's published by Massey University.
And join us, Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd, next Tuesday on Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.